Hello, my name is Dr. Glenn Wallace, and it's great to welcome you to the Success ID podcast, where we introduce you to leading thinkers, practitioners, and contrarians who share their views on what it takes to lead yourself and others successfully. On this week's episode, I'm joined by Chris Nell, who has had a very varied career, and since 2007 has been working to help senior leadership teams create sustainable strategic advantage by developing their adaptive capability. In this episode, Chris explains why the ability to respond rather than react is so important, especially in the current climate, what skills to develop in order to possess adaptive capability, and how to grow it in your own teams. Don't forget, we've also got an opportunity for some listeners to join David Pilbeam and I as guests on our monthly mashup show. You need to be available for the recording on the 24th of April, and there are more details about that at the end of this podcast. And it's my great pleasure to introduce you to my great friend, leadership facilitator and executive coach, Chris Nell. Chris, thank you so much for agreeing to be part of the Success ID podcast. It's lovely to have you on.
Hello, Glenn. It's great to be here.
Great stuff. Well, look, we've got a lot of work to cover, I think, because what's become clear to me as you and I have exchanged emails and started to chat around this topic is that it seems very much to have captured the zeitgeist of the moment. It seems to be very on trend, this idea of adaptation. And so with that in mind, if you were going to make a case, we start with this question with all of our guests, you know, if you were going to make a case for adaptation as success, what importance would you give it for people that want to lead themselves and others successfully?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the right place to start. I think it's a question I'd get, you know, from a lot of clients, a lot of prospects, which is, you know, why would we invest in this? And so I think it's, for me, being adaptive, you know, having adaptive capability in your organization is the only sustainable competitive advantage that you can have. I think other competitive advantages will come and go as the market changes or as, you know, the client requirements change. But being adaptive, you know, having this ability to recognize what needs to change and change it, I think is the only sustainable competitive advantage. And I think it should be the legacy of every leadership team is building this ability to change the organization. So that's
I love that. And I suppose to some extent that's built off the idea that the only constant is change.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think, and increasingly, I think people are starting to work that out. And, you know, we've been doing this for a while now, but I think it is our moment because people are really starting to feel overwhelmed by, you know, the rate of disruption around them. And so, you know, it's a much easier for us to sell what we do now than it was 5 or 10 years ago.
And that's really interesting. So I wonder for, you know, listeners who are, again, irrespective of context, whether it's that they're only concerned about leading themselves more successfully, or they've got a team that they're leading, or perhaps they lead an entire organization, or they lead a family. You know, the context is not so important to some extent. But why do you think adaptability then, what's changed? What's changed to make this so much more important to those people that are listening now than it might have been 5 or 10 years ago?
I think simply put, it's just the rate of change. I think it's the number of things that we're all being bombarded with in terms of disruption. And I think it used to be, Tom Peters, an ex-colleague of mine, always used to shoot off this great one-liner, which was, you know, it used to be that the big ate the small, now the fast eat the slow. And people used to laugh at him when he said that because they felt very safe in their big companies.
Yeah.
And now those people don't laugh at that joke anymore. Because they are starting to realise that they are being eaten alive by people that are faster than them. And I think that's really what's changed. It's about speed is probably the one word answer. Yeah. Everything's just happening so much more quickly than we can't react quickly enough.
Yes. Yeah, that's really, and I think we would recognise that in the work that we both do as coaches when you go into organisations where, you know, there's that people are experiencing change fatigue, but actually change is genuinely the constant state. It is, you know, iterating, reshaping, resizing, relocating, you know, all sorts of different changes that come along, but at such a rate that I don't think people can almost not stop to make sense of it all before they're into the next round of really significant change. We're not just talking about, you know, we changed the logo. We're actually talking about really deep level, structural, behavioural, strategic changes, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the Robert Keegan book that our friend and colleague David Pilbeam passed on to me with this In Over Our Heads, it just really, really captured that feeling of that we've got to rewire our brains. If we're going to thrive, if we're going to survive in this new jungle, yeah. We've got to rewire our brains. And I think that's, we're all a part of that. And I think that's why coaching is really getting some traction. And this idea of adaptive capability is really starting to strike a chord with people. So.
So we've established the fact that the rate of change is quicker than it has been previously, or at least that's the people's perception, and therefore they're struggling to adapt to that. You've used this phrase, this adaptive capability. Mm-hmm. In layman's and laywomen's terms, can you describe what that capability might look like and be like, and what the constituent parts of it are?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think what it is the organisation making a timely response to the changes in the environment, you know, the competitive environment in which they're working. Yeah. And I think over time, any organisation can change. That for me, the question is, can an organisation change in a timely way? Can it change quickly enough, mm-hmm. To survive and to thrive, or will it just be overwhelmed by the competitive forces? So I think that's what adaptive capability is.
Yeah.
I think its constituent parts, we describe that as sort of the three-legged stool. And a lot of attention in the past, I think, has been paid to one of those legs, and that is leadership. So leadership is a key part of being adaptable, mm-hmm. Because that's about inspiring people to want to make the change that you, as a leader, are convinced needs to be made. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you don't get this resistance to change. People, you know, people start to contribute in a way that they might not have contributed before. So leadership is one leg on this three-legged stool. But I think not enough attention has been paid in two other areas. And so the first area is awareness. And that's not just the awareness of, you know, the CEO or the executive team or whatever it is, the top. It's awareness across the organization that we've got to do something different here. And there's agreement and alignment about what that is. Mm. And Jim Kouzes, you know, the author of The Leadership Challenge, always says that you have to make not just the benefits of change apparent to people, but also the perils. So our brains, in order to make this appetite for change, we've got to really get into people's limbic brains, into that emotional part of their brain, and explain why change is important for them. And it mustn't just be a bit of, you know, company conference, la la, you know, our vision is to be whatever. It takes a concerted effort to build awareness across the organization.
Yeah.
And the third leg on the stool is learning, is the ability to benefit from the experiences that you're having in the organization. So I think in old world, in slow world, in, you know, big old corporate world, you know, you could get away with hiding failures. You could get away with hiding some of the clues that you needed to change because, you know, you had a lot of fat in the organization. You could absorb a lot of blows. I think we're eating that away very quickly. And this ability to learn from experience is really important. And again, that goes beyond just running a workshop on, you know, Kolb's learning cycle. You've actually got to teach people how to learn. And interestingly, in one of my previous lives in the military environment, I think where I saw the best learning reviews was where there was, if a negative outcome led to, you know, a really horrible, you know, a fatal experience. Mm. And then people got really good at learning. If the thought was, well, if we don't learn, someone might die next time. Then learning, the quality of learning, the quality of the conversations, the review process, and the willingness to commit resource to implementing that learning goes right up.
Yeah, and what a shame that, and I don't mean this in the military context, I just mean generally that's true personally. You see it very often, people are struck down by a particular illness and then review their lifestyle choices, for example. You know, organisations, when things are going sort of belly up, as opposed to that old adage of, you know, fix the roof whilst the sun's out kind of idea. I think it talks to a kind of proactivity, this adaptability. It's not just, you're not, the way that you've described it, and correct me if I've not quite got it, but it feels, A, it's proactive, B, yes, you are using it in the heat of the moment, but it is also a, you know, you develop the skill set kind of ahead of needing it, so you don't have to kind of knee-jerk react to things.
I think that's right, and my key learning moment around that one, really, I think, was as a junior army officer. I was going through a course called JDSC, Junior Division Staff College. And it was a fascinating time to be in the Army, because the Army had just worked out that it didn't know what to teach its junior officers in order to cope with life in the Middle East.
Right.
And the traditional doctrine pamphlets, they just didn't know what to write. They didn't know what advice to give us in terms of dealing with what we described as an asymmetric threat. And so what we were taught was what is called naturalistic decision making, or, you know, it was nicknamed ready, fire, aim. And the idea is that you start with a rough plan, an estimate of what's going on around you. And then you take that estimate and you act on it. So it's a very quick process. You don't spend a lot of time doing it, but you act with the intention of learning from what happens. And then the final piece of that is you adapt your plan. You go into a review phase where you say, right, so what worked well, what didn't work so well, right, what do we need to change? And we were taught that ahead of our deployment into, you know, Iraq and into the Middle East. And it was a framework that we were coached on in Shrivenham. And when we were out in theatre, when we were actually out in Iraq, we were holding each other accountable for that review phase.
Right.
But as the researcher at the centre of that, a guy called Gary Klein said, he said, it all depends on your willingness to admit that there was something wrong with the original plan.
Yeah.
I think sometimes that's where it goes wrong in the corporate environment, is teams, individuals have to say there's something wrong with the original plan. And I think people get defensive about their plans. So,
you've hit on a really golden streak here in relation to this adaptability piece, because of course in organisations, people want to see a plan. You know, they'll want to see a fully fledged, you know, end-to-end process. Shareholders want confidence in very large organizations, you know, from, you know, a strategic 3-year plan. And I get all that, but it's always felt a little, at best, artificial and kind of manufactured, which is, I think it was a military, I quoted this on a former podcast actually, and I perhaps should have done a bit more research into it, but it's something like von Bülow or I think it was an Austrian military commander who said, you know, a plan never survives the first contact with the enemy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And that ability to rather than then slavishly follow the plan, regardless of what's going on around you, that's surely sort of tantamount to, you know, to failure, I would think. And what you're saying is, I love that idea. I'm going to take that. I'm going to start to use that myself now. You know, I don't have a plan. I have an estimate, because a plan feels concrete. An estimate feels like that. This is my best guess from what we know.
And it was massive, you know, it was huge. And we had rather senior, you know, sort of crusty old brigadiers teaching us, and they were struggling to use the word estimate.
Right.
You could hear them struggling to get this word out, because before they'd always given orders to people and plans, and there was an appreciation that they'd done their appreciation. These were their orders, sort of thing. Right. And now what they're saying is, this is my estimate. And it's that language is really important, because it then gives people permission to revise the estimate, the plan.
Yeah.
And I think it's just more of that language in business would be useful, I think.
Well, and you are beginning to see it, right? So, you know, we do some work in the software development space, which is a completely new area to me. But, you know, they talk about, you know, agile approaches to manufacturing of the software, and that you wouldn't dream about writing a 3-year plan. In fact, you'd be lucky to get a 3-week plan. You know, there's a broad endpoint that you're very clear about, and then you iterate to that point. And I am beginning to see, I don't know whether you would share this experience, but I am beginning to see
agile project teams in organizations who seem to be capturing, this is why I think you're really onto such an important theme, is you're beginning to see those agile teams working in more of this way. Would that be your experience too?
No, definitely. I mean, the sense in our business that, you know, this is our moment, this is our time, because we're getting very little pushback.
Yeah.
Compared to, you know, 8-10 years ago, where people would, you know, they'd look at you with like snake eyes, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And now people's eyes widen and they go, oh yeah, no, actually this can really help. Yeah. because they are feeling overwhelmed, because they don't know what to teach, they don't know what advice to give, and they know that if they, you know, if they commit to a 3-year medium term plan, that it won't survive, you know, contact with the enemy. It won't survive contact with 3 months in the, whatever it is, you know, the IT competitive environment. And I think people know that stuff, so they feel almost fraudulent by issuing or, you know, orders, like, yeah, like my old brigadier pals. And actually they now need to start talking about, well, this is our best guess, this is our estimate.
Yeah.
Have a go at that, see what you can learn, you know, and adapt your plan. And actually, if you don't adapt your plan, I'll be more on your back. You know, I'll be asking you some serious questions if you're telling me you got it right first time. And that's very different to old world. When I say old world, I mean sort of 5 years ago.
Yes, we have to reframe old world, right? It's one of the things that you've mentioned, which has come up in a number of podcasts, but I have to say, by the way, in lots of different guises and under lots of different topics, is the importance of review. And the adaptability isn't just, you know, knee-jerk reacting. That's not what you're saying. This is a kind of planned, thoughtful, considered, but far, you know, fast where needed to be, response to a situation. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how busy leaders, again, in all kind of different contexts, but how busy leaders might create that time to, you know, what is the role of review, and how do people kind of create the time to do that? And bearing in mind, we've both said what a busy environment it is.
Yeah, and it is chicken and egg. I think once people work out how much time they're wasting by reacting rather than responding to what's going on around them, then I think they do make the time. They do carve out the time to do that. But somewhere you've got to break the cycle. And, you know, we've all done the time management courses with urgent and important, and know how difficult it is to break out of that cycle. But I think, you know, as with all limited resource environments, you've got to prioritize. You've got to start with the available resource you've got. And I think taking a team approach to this is also really important. I think, you know, leadership teams adopting this as a, well, now should we be engaging with this adaptive capability thinking, with naturalistic decision making? Do we start to issue estimates rather than plans? And I think it just, people need convincing. If they're convinced, they will make the time, because you know, they're smart people and they'll prioritize.
And I think that's a really clear message, actually, for people to take away from this, again, regardless of the context within which you're leading, which is that you, to some extent, A, you need to do stuff in order to get data back to review it and then respond and adapt, right? Mm-hmm. So that'd be part number one. You can't just sit in a cave and lead, that because leading is a verb, or to lead is a verb. Mm-hmm. But it is that you can actually try it, and you'll find that you save time by building quality review time into the process,
yeah,
rather than not, and just thinking working harder and faster is going to get you there.
Well, I think time's definitely a big part of it, but also that the burden of command is massive, you know, right? Having to come up with the right answer absorbs so much time, and so much, you know, I need to speak to a consultant, or I need to understand the latest research, or I need to read this book.
Yeah.
And actually, it's very liberating if you can get into your leadership team this idea that, you know, once the strategic intent is established in a business, actually people start to talk about what their own estimates are and make their own learnings. Mm-hmm. And then you become, you know, the leader as coach. You're facilitating that learning process. You're asking people, what have they learned? What have they tried new? And actually, it takes the burden of you needing to have the answers, because we know, you know, our dirty little secret, all of us, is we know we haven't got the answer. So what this does is this relieves you of that burden to provide the answer.
Yeah.
But what it does do is it gives you the tools to coach people to discover their own solutions. So I think,
that's a really good point, which is there's something about how you develop an adaptable mindset. And this ability to this capability, adaptive capability, in others. And you've mentioned kind of coaching as a leader. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little bit of an insight as to what that might look like? So I'm a leader of a team, and I want to generate this adaptive capability in the team so that we are better equipped to meet this kind of modern working context. What is that? What sort of concrete tips and tricks might you share with the audience on it?
Well, I think it's really about asking good questions. So rather than feeling like you've got to provide answers, I think what I see people that I'm coaching develop is a portfolio of good questions. Mm. And actually behind all of that is the sort of thought that I don't know the answer, and they're probably the three hardest words for a senior manager to ever utter, which is I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. But I wouldn't force people to say that phrase, but I think they do need to think it, and they've got to go, right, so how do I help people find out? How do I start to rewire their brains the right way so that they are doing the thinking?
Yeah.
So I need to provide direction. I need to provide, what are the outcomes we are required here? I need to provide, competitive analysis. So I need to give people all that information. So I've got to create the environment around them in which they can do the estimate.
Yeah.
And that it is okay to do the learning piece, and it is okay to lead. But apart from that, my role is to facilitate that thinking. It is not to provide the solution for people. And I think that requires considerable brain rewiring.
I think you're right, actually. And I love that idea that I would speak about it a lot to leaders. It's exhausting if you think you need to be the font of all knowledge.
Yeah.
And the problem with that is you can't adapt ultimately, because you could only adapt within the capability and the range of thinking that you can bring to the challenge, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're able to tap in and grow that ability across your team, yep, well, you're multiplying the possibilities. You're multiplying the ways that you could adapt, because you're encouraging and facilitating, as you said, a wider range of thinking approaches in your team.
Well, and I think then, we're then not doing diversity because it's a politically correct thing to do in our business. We're doing it because it's the survival plan for our business. We need to tap into the diverse thinking that we've got around us in order to solve this problem we've got, because nobody really has got the answer. We've got to iterate the answer as a team. I think
Let me just touch on one more part of your response, if I can, because I think it's so important. It's such a pivotal part for leaders listening to this to understand, I think, which is, I think I'm being paid as the leader of this team to have all the answers and to know everything. And for me to own up to not is likely to undermine the perception of me to my team, my peers, and my boss.
Yeah.
How do you help people over that? Kind of understandable, although it seems quite alien to me, mostly because I've got so many gaps, it would be difficult to hide them. But you could understand people's resistance to doing that. How do you kind of help people come to terms with that?
Well, I mean, we have a lovely moment in sooner or later with every senior team. We'll do something which sounds a bit like describing what our contribution is. So what is the contribution we make to this organization? And it's kind of the start of reprofiling your own role.
Right.
And I think inevitably what people do is they go from a rather, whatever it is, pedantic set of accountabilities as, the COO or whatever it is, to what contribution are you going to make here? And it's about going from being sort of solution provider to creating the environment in which this organization can do well. And I think people start to see that if they don't do that, no one else is going to do it in the organization. They're the people that are best placed to create environment, to create direction, to set the right tone, the right philosophy, the right culture. All that comes from the top. All the solution finding and execution stuff needs to happen somewhere else in the organization. But that's all a subset of what they create, the environment that they create. So, and I think that having that reprofiling conversation, how people view the contribution that they make, is really critical to all this, because I think otherwise people harbour these, exactly as you were saying, Glenn, these sort of thoughts, which is, yeah, but that's all very well, but I need to tell my team what to do. I need to set some objectives. I need to do this. I need to do that. Yeah. And I think we're mixing thinking up here about, you know, what is the role of a director? What is the role of an executive in an organisation? Mm. What's the primary contribution? What's the secondary contribution? So I think, you know, just having some of those conversations helps people see what their organisation needs from them.
Yeah, and you just reminded me of a coaching conversation I had not that long ago, and I'd had a number of conversations with this particular senior leader, and I just was getting this sense of defence, you know, sort of defending positions all the time, yeah. You know, and I said to her, you know, what are you defending constantly, mm. You know, and her response was, I didn't quite use that terminology, but you know, in short, her response was, you know, I feel I need to be the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
And you go, well, how on earth are you going to multiply the impacts and do all the things you've just so eloquently described for us that, you know, that shapes the environment, because that environment then just becomes a sort of cookie cutter of you, yeah, rather than brings in all of the different, you know, maximizes all the different human potential that there is in represented, not just your team, but in the entire organization. I don't know how you would liberate that if you're trying to enforce this kind of cloning almost of yourself. Doesn't make any sense to me at all. And she was quite relieved. I think she went, oh, nobody's really ever really explained it like that. And I think this is why, you know, I think some of the things that you and I are discussing, I think to some extent might be very familiar to some people and really, really new to others. And I think that's the interesting point around it. There's people who've adapted and are quite well down this road, and other people that are still quite stuck, you know, for no fault of their own, but just quite stuck in an old view world, bearing in mind that's only 5 years old, as we've described it. It's just interesting. It's a really interesting topic.
I think, I've got a 15-year-old son, and I can see my son's headmaster groaning whenever he sees me, because I'm right on the back of, you know, the educational brigade.
All right.
Because I think, you know, young kids under the age of 5 are brilliant at adaptive capability.
Right.
You know, they learn to, you know, walk by falling over. They learn to pick themselves up after they're off their bicycles and try it again. And we're just really good at adapting as kids. And then, you know, first day of school, it all goes wrong, because we start with this sort of thinking that there is a right answer, brackets, the teacher's got it. Yeah. I've just got to be smart enough to work out what the teacher's thinking. I've just got to be smart enough to regurgitate that in my GCSEs. I've just got to be smart enough to, and I think, you know, the people we work with as coaches have been through that system. They've done really well in that system. Mm-hmm. They've thrived in an educational system. And their brains are wired to feel like there is an answer. And, you know, if only I was smart, and if only I was the smartest person in the room, and if I haven't got the answer, then I'm a fraud, I'm an imposter. And I think people need to start seeing their roles as facilitators and coaches rather than as providers of, you know, the answer. Because if anyone tells you they've got the answer, they're probably lying. You know, you've got to liberate people to work those answers out for themselves based on what they're looking at on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're closer to the ground that they're working in and on, and therefore you imposing an answer from way outside of that may not be best fit, albeit very well intended. You just touched on something that I'd like your insight into is, do you think that there are some people who are, well, it's a kind of nature nurture debate, I guess, Chris, which is, you know, are people more adapt, you know, got greater propensity to be adaptive than others, or do we all have it but we've had it sort of drilled out of us at various rates because of the nurture side? What's your kind of take on nature versus nurture in relation to adaptive capability?
I was asked this at a conference last week, actually, about
right. Right.
It was interesting because I think the British Army dubbed me as a high functioning dyslexic. And so I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about dyslexia and the number of, there are a lot of dyslexic people in the Army. And it's got me thinking about, you know, the depending on your version of it, it's kind of there's I have trouble in processing things, in memorizing things. So the idea of going and learning all the solutions to the things that I should be doing in Iraq in 3 months' time filled me with absolute horror. Right. Hence my liberation when someone said, look, here's a really simple formula for working out what is the right thing to do. So for me, I think there are some people, not necessarily dyslexic, but there are some people who have had to struggle in their lives to work things out. They may have had crises, you know, they may have some form of disability, they may have a mental disability or a physical disability. But I think people who have struggled know that they need to search for a solution, you know, that they're constantly sort of fighting the system to make it work. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's one interesting group, you know, people who've struggled with things that have surprised them in life, things that have gone wrong, people who've generally struggled with the system. So I think they're an interesting group to look at. I think there's an age component to this as well, which is, you know, the more you've experienced, I think the more you tend to fall back on the experiences that you've had rather than search for new solutions. So that scenario fulfillment driver is much stronger the more experience you have. So I think that's another group that might be interesting to look at. Yeah. And I think the third area, sorry, Glenn, the third area would be seniority. I think the problem in if you have seniority is that you've got the power to just enforce your point of view. And you may not want to use it in a powerful way, but by the very nature that the three letters after your name are CEO, yeah, people will do what you say, for whatever reason. So that's quite seductive in terms of getting things done quickly. Is right, just because people will see what you say as a list of instructions to go.
That's a really, really important. Just a quick takeaway: that kind of shadow of the leader, or that implicit power that comes just with the title.
Yeah,
that's really. You touched on just to recap, scenario fulfillment. In your sort of experience is what, and a little bit more into that piece around the role of experience and how that can hinder your openness to adaptation and being adaptable. Because I think it's a really, because you look at the age profile of many leaders and they are by nature, you know, they're longer in the tooth because they've got more experience. So I wonder if for listeners who might be of an experience and or age profile, where this could be a watch out for them. Can you speak a little bit to that? Because I think it's a really fascinating theme.
Well, scenario fulfillment was dropped out of some research that Gary Klein was doing in the Pentagon in 1989. And what they noticed after a rather tragic incident where an Iranian airliner got shot down, flight 655, got shot down by a US ship, US Navy ship. Right. What they discovered was that people were going back and fulfilling old training scenarios in their heads rather than dealing with the rather confusing and contradictory information that they were getting through their sensing devices on the ship. So the radar, the acoustic and all that sort of stuff. And they were ignoring all the contradictory signals and they were paying more attention to the things that they had experience of before in their lives. And they call that scenario fulfillment. So what we tend to do is we tend to fall back on the things that have a high degree of certainty in our minds because it makes us feel like we can cope with the situation. Yeah. And the more anxious we are, you know, the more threatened we feel, the more we tend to do that. And it's an evolutionary thing, you know, that, well, if you've lived this long, then what you did last week must have kept you alive sort of thing. And I think that's because of the thing we spoke about earlier, Glenn, about speed and rate of change and number of disruptive forces, because that's just getting faster and faster and faster. What we did 5 years ago will not work. It won't help us. Won't help us thrive. You know what they're teaching my children in school now won't necessarily help them deal with, you know, the way the world's going to be in 5-10 years' time.
Yeah, really interesting. So a phrase that sprung into my head as you were talking about that was kind of, you know, reverting to type. So you fulfill scenarios that are well sort of pre-programmed in your head, and increasingly so under pressure is again a really helpful thing, which is, you know, and therefore you need to be able to take yourself out of that loop, I guess, and you need to break that cycle of kind of almost automatic thinking or automatic decision making to give you the break between the input and whatever you decide is output.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one really practical example of how you can use that piece of information in your organization is thinking really hard about who you're recruiting. Are you recruiting people based on they've got great experience in the past, yeah, or for what you need them to do in the future? And I think what a lot of recruitment looks like is, oh, they've got a lot of experience in our world, yeah, and that makes them great, and therefore we'll hire them. And I think people just need to just press the pause button and go, what do we need these guys to do in 5 years' time? Yeah. Recruit them for those capabilities rather than what they've done in the past. And I think that, you know, we're working with a company at the moment that's got a, they are going to recruit people very bravely who have no experience in that industry at all, and not to completely replace everyone at that level in the organization, but just to add in enough new thinking, enough questioning into the organization. So I think it's
that speaks to that third leg of the stool that you were talking about, which is the learning, right? So if you're not constantly learning and updating yourself and making it and keeping yourself relevant, you're going to become redundant, both literally and metaphorically, pretty quickly.
Well, I think there's something about the about awareness as well. I think if you've spent 35 years in the insurance industry, you know, your awareness of some of the things going on in AI or in, you know, some of these other big disruptive forces may be quite limited. Whereas, you know, if you've been around the bazaars in various industries doing various different things, you bring something new and interesting to the team. And I'm not suggesting we recruit with the intention of creating anarchy in the organization, but I think we tend to recruit in our own likeness, and we recruit people that make us feel comfortable and all those sorts of things. And too much of that is unhelpful.
Yeah. And it touches on the point you mentioned earlier on, around diversity, not being about quotas. It is also about diversity of thinking. You could have a very diverse group by some measures, but the diversity of thinking is no wider just because you've brought in, you know, people from all sorts of other diverse groups. Yeah. I think diversity in all its forms is glorious. And I think where we try and homogenize groups of human beings, but societally, you know, we want there to be a single Europe. Well, you might, and I understand that from a political sort of structural position, but, you know, the fact that you can go to France and the French are very different from the Italians, very different from the British, you know, and people within those countries are also very different too. You know, that it's the difference we should be relishing. Yeah, yeah. In my view,
it's diversity of capability that we need, isn't it? Yeah. Really, we need that. We need all those different capabilities. So, I thought you were baiting me then for a Brexit.
No, let's not. We're definitely not even going in there. Look, this has been absolutely incredible. I could spend a lot more time on this, but I know that you've got other meetings to go to. So I just want to ask you a question, Chris, that we ask everybody, which is, you've given us so many tips and insights and advice and so much advice. If you were going to suggest that for this audience of the Success ID podcast, if they were going to just start to focus on one area to dial up their ability and their adaptive capability, not that everything else that you've said isn't really important, but if there was one thing you'd say, look, focus on this, you get your biggest bang for your buck, what would you say they would be well advised to focus on?
Oh, that's a great question, isn't it? Because it's such a, we feel like we're so busy and there's so much to do with this stuff. To boil it down to one feels really hard.
Yeah. I didn't say it was going to be easy.
It's a good question. I think firstly, I would say, I think people should try and reframe how they see themselves, you know, give themselves permission to be environment creators rather than solution providers. Okay. I think that's a really important step for people to make. I think the other thing is, and it's that humility, it's the Jim Collins humility, you know, that level 5 leadership thought Jim Collins had about humility and drive. And I think the humility to accept that you're part of the problem. That it's not the inability of, you know, middle managers to execute on, you know, that actually the way we are leading is part of the problem here. And I think when teams start to get that, when you get that humility, like we haven't got the answer, we need to work it out, then we start to make some progress. So I think, you know, the Yeah, I think that's it. I think reframing how you see yourself as an environment creator rather than a solution provider. And having the humility to go, look, I'm probably, if we're not performing here, I'm probably part of the problem. And you know, it's a really, I know it's a long road for me as a facilitator when people say to me, no, we get this in the boardroom. Can you just go and sort out our, I heard them called the permafrost the other day, the middle management group, the permafrost. Can you just go and do this adaptive stuff with them? Because they need to be more adaptive. And so, you know, I know we're on a long journey with that, those guys.
Plenty of opportunity to produce and facilitate change. Look, Chris, it's an absolute delight. And I've taken a lot away, and I know that the audience will have too, because it seems that you are working in a space that is absolutely of the moment. I think it's always been important, but I think, as you suggested earlier on, there's more awareness for leaders and for organisations that this is such a hot topic. So we've been absolutely privileged that you've come and spent some time sharing your thoughts with us. So thank you so much from all of us.
It's a pleasure, Glenn. It's been great fun. Thank you. Good
question. Okay, we look forward to catching up with everybody on the next episode of the Success ID podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Success ID podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to and learning more about how you can lead yourself and others successfully. My challenge to you is to take the ideas and wonderful content that Chris Nell provided and find a way of putting it to work for you today.
Full show notes and more information about Chris Nell and his work are available at www.successid.co.uk. Also, you can subscribe to the Success ID podcast by going to iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Success ID podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to and learning more about how you can lead yourself and others successfully. My challenge to you is to take the ideas and wonderful content our guests provided and find a way to put some of it to work today. Show notes are available on www.successid.co.uk. To make sure you don't miss an episode, please subscribe to the Success ID podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher. We look forward to welcoming you to the next episode of the Success ID podcast.